All right, good morning. Hope you all had a nice morning tea. I didn't actually see what they were offering on selection, but I hope you enjoyed it. So my name's Donovan. I work for a company called Provoke Solutions, based in the Wellington office. Got offices in Auckland, Manila, and Seattle as well. And I'm gonna be talking to you today about Azure storage architecture, and specifically how you get the most out of your Azure storage and also premium storage. So a little bit about me. I'm an infrastructure consultant and team lead, working with SharePoint, Skype for Business, aka the artist formerly known as Link, Office 365, and of course Azure, which I'm going to talk to you about today. So a bit of an agenda. We're going to run through what exactly is Azure storage, the architecture of the back end within the data centers of storage, how we can improve performance, and then we're going to look into a bit of depth for premium storage. Now, can I just get a feel for the audience? How many of you actually are using Azure today? So a reasonably good number. Cool. So the takeaway that I want you to really walk away with is better knowledge around how storage is put together in the back end, where the constraints and limitations are, and how you can use this to improve your efficiency and throughput for the actual storage systems that you're building. So this won't talk specifically about IaaS, it's about all of the Azure storage types. And so we're going to run through just quickly about what these storage types are. And this is a bit of an overview. Most of you have used Azure, so I'm pretty sure you've all seen what the different types of storage are that are there. So for a start, Azure storage, what is it? Well, it really is one of the key building blocks of the Azure solution. Without it, we wouldn't have a data center, you wouldn't have your IaaS, you wouldn't have any of your websites, you wouldn't have SQL. It really is one of the fundamentals that's needed. It's obviously everywhere that Azure is. These current locations, plus more being added soon. I'm not sure if Canada is specifically one of those blobs, but that's coming online soon. you know, and it's used by Microsoft themselves for global reach for things like Xbox, Skype, OneDrive, and Bing. They all use it in some way, shape, or form. So as I said, it's globally available. It is everywhere. They're doing millions of transactions per second. I think the last figure I heard was around about 5 to 6 million transactions per second. This was about a month ago, so that's probably increased somewhat since then. Literally trillions and trillions of objects stored in Azure. It's a flexible system. You can interact with it via REST, a number of different client libraries, and the more being added really frequently. I'm not sure if iOS is released yet or is about to be released, but that's another one that's coming, as well as .NET, Java, Windows Phone, Android, etc. You can also leverage Azure storage via hybrid connections, things such as StorSimple, where you want to expand your local storage up into Azure for that 80% of stuff that's not used frequently. StorSimple device simply ships it up into Azure storage for use when you actually need it. Similarly for backups and disaster recovery, when you're backing up to Azure, it's stored in blob storage in Azure, and for disaster recovery, you're storing it as basically VHDs. It's durable. By default, you get 3 copies of your data. Every time you create an object, you get 3 more copies of that. If you really want, you can turn on geo-redundancy and get 3 more copies in a completely different region. This is all pretty standard stuff with Azure storage. And there's basically 4 main components that make it up. There are blobs, tables, queues, and files. And so we'll just run quickly through about what each of these are. So blobs, there are 3 versions of blobs. Block blobs are basically files stored in Azure. They're similar to what you would be storing on your hard drive, just binary objects, pictures, backup files, installers, that sort of thing. they're pretty simple. They're basically optimized for sequential I/O, so where you're writing in chunks of data or blocks of data into that file at various different points. You have page blobs, which are essentially your VHD files, your IaaS disk files. These are very similar to block blobs, except they are optimized for random reads and writes, because obviously you're not going to be writing to a specific area in your disk in large chunks. It'll be a write here and a write there. And finally, append blobs. These are basically the same as block blobs. They just were announced a couple of weeks back that they are available. They're essentially for logging, so they're optimized for writes to the end of the file, so appends. That's their specific use. You can't actually write to the middle of a file, but you can, however, read from it. Then we've got tables. So tables is basically structured data within Azure Storage. It's NoSQL optimized for fast key value lookups. Areas where you're not requiring complex joins or foreign keys, store procedures, that sort of thing. It's not relational data, but it is very good for fast key value lookups. Then we've got queues. So queues are basically a messaging system built on Azure Storage. They're used for like decoupling components, or we want to send a bunch of data to be processed via Tasker, asynchronously. You just fire it off to a queue and let it sit there and process. And then finally, files. So files is basically just block blobs fronted by an SMB protocol. So, map a network drive as you normally would. It's just sitting there in Azure Storage, and you can read and write to it using the file system as per normal. This is still in preview. However, if you've got an enterprise agreement, you can actually get technical support, which is, I think, is the first time that Microsoft actually has done this while something's still in preview. So they're pretty confident about the service, and no doubt it will GA very soon. So that's just a really high-level overview of what makes up Azure Storage. So we'll dive a little bit deeper and look into how it's really put together in the back end. And then we'll work our way back up and look at some examples of how we can use this knowledge and make our systems better. So within the Azure data centers, and if you attended Jaron's session yesterday, you would have seen some pretty pictures of some big square buildings and some containers. Pretty exciting stuff. There is basically this concept of what they call a storage stamp. Now, a storage stamp, although it looks it on the screen, isn't a single rack, it's multiple racks of servers. So multiple racks of multiple servers serving your basically storage systems. And they're split into three distinct layers. The front-end layer is basically where your requests are coming into. It basically handles that request coming in for authentication, metering, that sort of thing, and then passes it off to the partition layer. So the partition layer, this is probably where we'll spend a bit of time in some future slides going over, because it's really the area that we are going to focus on where we can get the best performance benefits from Azure Storage. So the partition layer is basically what knows about your data. It handles the load balancing across the partition stream, and also handles the interstamp replication. So this is where you would get your geo redundancy happening. So that's an async replication. So it's not you're not waiting on the partition layer doing its replication before it gets written to the stream layer, which brings me to the stream layer. The stream layer is basically where your ones and zeros are stored. Stream layer knows absolutely nothing about your data, only that it's there and it needs to replicate it. So the replication that happens at this layer is the your three synchronous copies. So it's basically your local replication. So an example of a write request coming into a storage stamp. you know, it could hit any front-end server. It doesn't really matter. There's load balancing in front of that, so it just fires off to the least busy one. Then your storage, whatever you're writing to might be assigned to partition server 4, which then feeds it off to where it's stored primarily on stream 5, which then replicates it to another 2 stream servers. So talking about partition, the partition layer and the partition layer being very key, so dig a little deeper into that. Some key concepts to think about when you're looking at the partition layer. Like I said, there are multiple servers. Each server can have multiple partitions assigned to it, and we'll define how you actually get to what a partition is in the next slide. But the things to think about are that the scale of your partition is limited by what the partition server can serve. And you can only have one, your partition can only be assigned to one partition server, so it can't be spread across multiple. And when you're hitting sort of the partition server limits, that's what's known as a hot partition, and we don't want those, we want to try and avoid those. So where we've got data across multiple partition servers or partitions, that can be automatically load balanced by Azure. So how do we get a partition? Each different type of storage entity has a slightly different way of assigning partitions. For blobs, block and append, the path and the name are the partition key, and therefore they are the partition. Same with page blobs, a disk is just a blob, so therefore it's a partition as well. Tables, it's a little bit easier. There is actually an entity in tables called partition key, and so each partition key is a partition. So where you have multiple entries using the same partition key, they're all going to use the same partition. For queues, the queue name is partition key, and for files, each file share is partition key. So pretty straightforward, but you know, how do we use this to get more efficient or better throughput? So I'm going to use an example of tables. The concepts that I'm talking about apply to all of the storage types. Tables is just an easy way of visually representing it. So really simple table. Populations of some New Zealand cities. Had to include Invercargill because why wouldn't you? basically, this would be a lot easier if I was in the United States doing it partition key by states, but if we went with region in New Zealand, we'd probably only have one entry per partition key. So chunked it up via upper and lower North and South Islands. So you can see there that you know we've got a few entries with the same. And if we look at an example query, you know, we want to get the population of Wellington. So we know our partition key, we know our row key. Partition key means that it's stored on partition server 5. This is a really, really efficient query. It's going to be the fastest query that you can do, and it will return that data very quickly. If we want to get a slightly more complex query where we want to get population of the upper North Island cities of above 300,000, you can start to see we're spreading some load across multiple stream servers. So we're still using a single partition key, so it's still one partition server that's being used. But the returning is, you know, three different entities. So they might be stored. They might be stored on the same stream server, but for the purpose of this example, we'll say they're on 3. Where we start getting to, this might be if you were working with blobs, this would be similar to a get blob operation where it's returning chunks of data from that blob. So we're moving into a more complex query now. So if we get rid of that partition key and we just say we want to get all cities with less than 150,000 people, so that operation then has to span multiple partition servers, which then are going to query multiple stream servers. So if you've got thousands of rows, like my example is, you know, only a few rows. If you've got thousands or millions of rows, a query like this is going to be really, really inefficient, and it's going to be slow. and that means your application is going to be slow. And you're probably going to end up hitting performance limits. So for tables, there's a 20,000 entity per second request limit. And if you're doing a request like this, and even if you're just returning, you know, a few items of data, if you're scanning thousands of items, all those thousands of items are counted towards that limit. So you're probably going to get throttling messages and that sort of thing. And that's not going to be a good experience for you. So how do we make it better? So let's look at our table again. For Azure table storage, or in Azure storage itself, data is pretty cheap. Especially when you compare it to, say, SQL, where SQL you pay for, sorry, Azure SQL, you pay for a 250 gig database, and you can use up to 250 gig, whatever that, you're still going to pay for it. Azure storage, you only pay for what you use. So in this instance, because we want to be querying by population, you know, it may be worth duplicating some of that data and denormalizing it. Now, denormalizing is probably a little dirty word in most SQL circles, but in this instance, it works out better for us. So now you see we're adding a new partition key based on how we're going to be querying the data. So it's still returning the same value of the population, but because we know that we're going to be querying by population size, it makes more sense to do it this way. So if we look at that query again with the old table and the old partition key, super inefficient, we turn it into something more like that with the new partition key. So it's going to be a much more efficient scan than a full table scan. This is going to be what they call a partition scan, and it's going to be, much more efficient than the other operation. And this still applies to things like blobs, where if you need to query a blob by some different metadata or something like that, you would just simply copy that blob and create it with different metadata. Again, you're only paying for what you're using. So that's all good for tables and efficiency. I'm sure a lot of you probably have spun up some VMs in Azure using Azure IaaS. You might have even done a lift and shift of some workloads. How do we make performance better and for disks on there? So example I've seen is where a customer did exactly that. They wanted to pick up a workload they had running on-prem, and they wanted to put it in Azure. It was some hardware that was coming end of life. So the specs on it were pretty straightforward: 4 CPUs, 6 gig, 2 data disks, and they were getting around about 3,000 IOPS, give or take, on that first data disk. The second one was pretty lightly used, basically storing PDF files for retrieval every now and then. So looking at the specs of that, you know, a standard A3 seems like a good fit. You know, CPU is about bang on. Memory, yeah, that's fine. We can have 8 data disks, so there's no problem creating two different data disks for our intensive workload for our first set and second set. But what they experienced was actually really poor performance. Now, has anyone picked up a workload and put it in Azure kind of like this and then were a bit less than impressed at the disk performance that they were getting through? Well, these guys were. So how do we make it better? Well, so if we go back to the concepts that we were talking about before, each disk is just a blob. And each blob is a different partition key and therefore a different partition. And so we're bound by that 500 IOP limit for each disk. And the other one, which I'll come back to, you pay for what you use. It's kind of a key concept. Better way of doing it is use Windows storage spaces. So storage spaces came out in Server 2012. Before that was, you in theory could use some sort of software RAID, but storage spaces is much better. So with this, we would then look at using the maximum number of disks that we can for that Azure VM, which is 8. So we would assign 7 disks in a single storage pool for that second data disk. And that increases our IOP throughput from 500 maximum writes to around about 3,500. and we're still paying the same. So we're still only using 400 gig because we set our storage space at 400 gig, so we're only paying for 400 gig, but we've increased our performance for nothing. Recommendations if you're going to do this, create your VHD files to the maximum of around about a terabyte. This will just allow you to increase your storage in future without having to go back into expand those VHDs from Azure PowerShell. And the good thing, obviously, because we already have locally redundant data, we don't have to worry about losing a disk, because this is going to be striped across all these disks for throughput. We still have the three locally redundant copies on the back end, so we don't need to worry about disk failures. If you were doing this on-prem, you would be freaking out. Seven spinning disks, the odds of one of them failing, pretty high. And the other thing to think about in this sort of situation is, so the second data disk, well, it's not using a lot of reads and writes. It's not a lot of throughput. It's just serving out PDFs to be accessed by the application. Why not use Azure Files or something, some other abstraction for that data? If we get rid of that other data disk, we can add one more into the pool and get more throughput. So just quickly have a look at what this looks like. So yes, that was my Provoke animal. Just so you know, everyone at Provoke has an animal. I'm a red squirrel. Yeah, because of the beard, which I grew specifically for that. Knew I was going to be working there. So what we've got here is just our standard virtual machine. You know, 4-core. That's the wrong one. That's the premium one. This one. 4-core, 7 gig of memory, two disks attached, pretty simple. And what I'm going to use here is a tool called Iometer, or Iometer, depending on how you like to say it. Basically a synthetic disk transaction workload. Just spins up a bunch of workers and writes or reads things from disk, basically in small transactions. So it's just a good way of measuring what the potential throughput, what the potential IOPS or throughput, depending on how you're, what you're designing for your systems are. So if we fire this up, we can see that shut up pretty quick, and then it's going to come back around to about 500 max write IOPS per second. So it won't really move from that. And that's just with one disk attached. So if you really need to get some better performance through that, you know, we look at the same size VM, but with a storage pool created where we've got our seven disks attached in that storage pool. Again, you can see they're all a terabyte in size. If we run the same workload on this, anytime. So we can start to see that by simply just adding more disks, we're getting even better than expected throughput, IOPS per second. That will actually probably come down to hover around about 3,500. So we're not paying any more for this. We're just using the disks that are available to us to increase that throughput. And even if you don't think that you'll need that much throughput, they're there. Why not use them? It will mean a better experience when you're using IaaS. So just to summarize some of the key concepts here, think about when you're designing systems, not just for IaaS, but for anything that you're building with Azure Storage, the partition layer is really key. You don't want inefficient queries where you're not defining which partition server to use because you'll hit throttling limits. So if it makes sense to duplicate that data, because it will just end up being really slow, and it will. You might think that I don't care about, you know, if it's going to be a slow query, but you will. Similarly, if when you were looking at IaaS VMs, you know, spread the load across multiple servers. Don't run into the hot partition scenario where you're fully loading up one single partition and it's causing you performance issues. And think about, you know, alternate abstractions for what it is that you're using. As I mentioned, files might be a better scenario for that VM. Similarly, you might be better off storing logging information in applications in blobs, such as the append blob, which is where it came about. You know, it might be a better choice than table. Logging information might seem like it's structured data, but if you think about how you actually use logging data, you never really return a single value. You never look at one log entry specifically. When you go to troubleshoot or look at something, you want to look at a chunk of logs, like for a day or, you know, a few hours. So blobs are probably a better situation for that. So a slight change of tack. We're going to have a look at the new Azure Premium Storage offering. And I'm not sure if you seen this morning, there was a bit of an announcement around the GS series and DS series VMs in Azure Storage. We'll cover that off briefly. I didn't get a chance to change my slides, so unfortunately it's out of date. Damn this release cadence. So Azure Premium Storage GA back in April. It's currently available in 8 locations. I think the newest was one of the data centers in Japan, which was a couple of weeks ago, and Australia East, maybe a week or so before that. So there are more coming soon. There was a blog post the other day with the planned expansions in the data centers. I think there's a couple more in the US and Europe. But yeah, keep an eye out for them. But probably most relevant for people here is going to be Australia East. So how is premium storage different to standard storage? Well, quite simply, it's backed by SSDs. Now, SSDs aren't exactly a new concept for Azure IaaS VMs. The D series and G series have had SSDs for their temporary drives for some time. But what we're talking about here is SSDs backed in the blob space. So where before you would be storing it on standard spinning disk, your blobs are actually going to be stored on solid state. So this is really to achieve, you know, high I/O performance and low latency for your reads and your writes. There are slightly different ways of billing and paying for the disk types. Whereas before it was pay for what you use, now you're paying by the disk type that you use. So if you only need 10 gig of, for example, a P10, which is the 128 gig, you're still going to pay for that full 128 gig. And the reason for that is because it's kind of getting away from the thinking of paying for storage. Really what we're paying for here is performance. So it's not just how many gig do I need or how many terabytes do I need, it's how many IOPS, how much throughput do I need to get the best out of this system. And to use these new disk types, there's two new VM types. So I mentioned the DS and GS series, the GS, which is affectionately known as the Godzillas, which we'll show you a demo of at the end. So looking at the numbers, as I mentioned, I don't have a chance to change my slides. So this is the known figures for the DS14, which is the largest of the DS series. 50,000 write IOPS and over 64,000 read IOPS. And that 64,000 read IOPS can be from a single disk. You can have up to 32 terabyte of data and 512 megabytes of throughput. So the GS series that was announced, the numbers that were announced this morning were 80,000 write IOPS. Read IOPS weren't specified, but up to 2,000 megabytes per second throughput. all while still getting three local copies of your data. So the disks themselves, as I mentioned, three different types, and they have different size limits, but also different throughput and IOP limits. So the P10, you know, you can get 500 IOPs. The P30, you can get 5,000. And you can mix and match these disks. So if you want to attach a P10 and a P20, you can, to get whatever IOP target that you're looking for. And we'll look at some examples of how we can do this later on. So the new virtual machines, as I mentioned, this is just a snippet of what's there. If you want to use Azure Premium Storage, you have to use these VMs. Currently, the GS series is only available in, I think, three data centers, maybe four. It's basically US, US East 2 and West US and Europe. I believe, West Europe. The DS series is available in all the areas that I mentioned earlier. But if you really want to use the GS, I encourage you to go and spin one up and just leave it sitting there. Jaron will be happy, we'll make his target. So as I said, you can mix and match the disk types, the disks, the P series, but not only that, but you can also add on standard storage disk as well. So where you've got workloads that you don't actually need high disk performance, like, for example, you were just storing something slowly, but you have other, you might store backups on a, you know, SQL backups locally for transaction logs and that sort of thing. You know, you can use standard storage to store that or, the thing that really makes these VMs different is the blob cache. Now the blob cache is basically how we achieve the really high read IOPS. It's basically using RAM drives and SSDs to cache data, because as you'll see there, not only is there that local SSD size limit, but there's also that cache size limit. So the local SSD that's been around for a while on the D and G series, but the actual cache size is where you're getting your performance benefits for reads. So, like I say, it's used to boost reads and writes. Used to boost reads, and the cache is shared for all disks that have it enabled on that VM, and it doesn't count towards your IOP limit. So you can have 50,000 write IOPS happening on some disks and still not be affected. And if you're having your 64,000 reads, you know, it's not going to impact the writes that's happening. So the cache limits themselves are based on CPU, based on how many cores it's got. Same with the, so that affects IOPS and throughput. So if you've got the biggest VM in the D series, so the DS14, you'll get that over 64,000 limit. If you scale it back to a DS1, you're going to get a lot less in terms of read, but still better than standard storage. So some recommended settings. By default, read-write caching is turned on for the OS disk. You can't turn that off from what I've seen. When you create a new premium storage disk, it will be set as read only. If you're going to use those disks for heavy writes or write only, turn that caching off. It's not going to be of use when you're doing your writes. And if you need something that has high read on that same VM, it will potentially impact the usage of the reads from the other disk. So, just looking at a bit of detail, the actual how it's plugged together. So we've got the the SSD level provisioning here, which is basically your cache. The SSD level provisioning is where you're reading from and writing to, if you're using the local disk, that local SSD that's attached to the VM. So whenever you're doing a cache hit, it will come from that local cache. And that's the reason why you wouldn't want to use it for writes is, you know, if there was an unexpected outage and something was in the middle of a write using that cache, you're probably going to lose that data. So those SSDs that are attached are like all temporary storage in Azure IaaS. It doesn't persist if you shut down or deprovision your VM. Everything on there will get wiped. You can, however, use this local SSD for temporary storage. Things like SQL TempDB or the SQL 2014 buffer pool cache. You know, you can create scripts to create the folder structure that you need in there and have your TempDBs stored on that local SSD for really high reads and writes. So the limits of our write operations are really constrained by the network level. When I say network level, you can think of it kind of like an iSCSI SAN connection attached to those SSDs that are on the storage stamps. So that's basically what's happening. It's, you know, you've got all these SSDs. You could add, you know, I think it's up to 32 SSDs to a DS14, but you're still not going to get the 32 times 5,000 write IOPS because you're hitting that network level constraint. And so that's really where that 50,000 is coming in. The GS series obviously has a higher constraint there of 80,000 write IOPS for the network level. And so where you're hitting any cache misses will again use that that network level provisioning. So we'll just have a quick look how this isn't the Godzilla one. This would just be a similar look at. So if we were taking that same workload that we talked about earlier and moving it into premium storage, you know, what would that look like? So we've got a DS3 VM here, so it's got slightly higher memory allocation. CPU is still 4-core. What I've got here is just one single P30 disk attached. If I find my window that I had open before. So this is it here, the single P30 settings. Cool. So we've just got our one data disk here, and that's there's no caching set on that. So there's one disk attached, 1 terabyte, done. And if we run the same workload that we had earlier, we can see straight away we're getting around about 5,000 IOPS throughput, just one disk. We'll show you what it looks like when you attach multiple disks to the biggest GS series in an upcoming slide, upcoming demo. So yeah, so that's pretty simple. So if you've got you know, high intensive workloads that you need to actually get really good disk throughput, and I/O performance through, you should consider using Azure Premium Storage. I think Hamilton City Council moved one of their workloads as soon as it became available, and got 10 times the performance out of the exact same workload that they were running from standard storage to premium storage. So that's the type of thing that you can get through there. Now, one thing about me, I do like beer. Being from Wellington, I enjoy a beer or two, so I had to include a beer somehow in my presentation. So this is just really to talk about the when you're putting together an Azure Premium Storage VM, think about the disk limits and of both the sorry, think about the disk limits for I/O and throughput, but also the VM limits for our own throughput, because that will be your total, that will affect the total I/O that you can get for your system. So as an example, you know, we want to target, try and get 4,000 IOPS for whatever the system is. So we attach P30 because we can get 5,000 IOPS, and that's fine. But we only need, you know, really low CPU and, well, we think we only need low CPU and RAM for whatever our system is, but we're not hitting that number. So you need to think about not only just CPU and RAM and storage, but also IOPS as well. So you need to make sure that, you know, you're allocating a VM that has the right limit that you can make the most of that storage. So we increase it to a DS2, which has 64,000 limit, and we cap out now at 5,000 IOPS per second. Similarly, for disks, you know, if you're looking at, we allocate DS3, it's got plenty, we need to hit try and 7,000, we're capped here at 5,000, which is a single disk. So cool, no problem, we just add another P30. Blow that target out of the water. But if you want to save some money while you're doing this, you can attach P20. You're still making your target, you're still putting in that storage space, and you're saving a bit of cash. Unfortunately, there isn't a VM that sits in that other anything in between a 2 and a 3 to make it, you know, at that level, but there will be some, I guess, capacity wasted. You could always attach another P30 and, you know, really ramp up your workloads, but, you know, if you want to maintain cost savings, you only need that amount, only attach P20. How am I going for time? Easy. So, last little demo, and I apologize, normally I like demo heavy presentations myself. It's hard to demo ones and zeros moving a lot for this, so I would have liked to have just talked around all of a demo, but unfortunately it's just little snippets. So again, our final demo is our Godzilla machine. This was the one that Jaron showed in his presentation yesterday. 32 cores, 448 gig of memory, and it's doing heaps. So what we've got here is, again, our storage pool. Now I've actually got 20 P30 disks in the storage pool, just to see if we could squeeze a couple of extra numbers out of the over and above that 80,000 IO limit, because up until today those numbers weren't really published except for in the preview portal. So we've got those 20 disks in that pool. We've also got a single P30, which is our read disk here, and that's got it's got caching turned on. So if we have a look at the sort of numbers that we can get out of this, so again, using the same workload that we did on all the other demos, I literally copied the file from one to another and pasted it on there. So there's nothing special about it. No black magic and wizardry to make this one look better. So what you'll find here is the actual writes themselves. This is write performance. What I found from my demo, from testing this out, is it takes a little bit to ramp up. I'm not sure why the reason is. Maybe someone from Microsoft can tell me, but this will eventually kick up to 80,000 write IOPS per second. Just for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to like click and go and jumping straight up to 80,000. So if we look at our our read performance, so this is, again, a similar workload, except we've changed our write operations to full random reads, and we're targeting that one single read disk that I've got there. So now what I will say is that if you run out and try this at home, as soon as you click the go button, it's probably not going to look that great because it takes a while for the cache to obviously warm up. You need to have things read from the cache repeated times before you can actually get that number. So you can see here we're getting around about 160,000 read IOPS from a single disk, and that's just using all of that cache that's available there. So that in itself is pretty impressive because the only demo I've seen for premium storage had kind of maxed out at around about 100,000 IOPS, and that was combined reads and writes. That was at Ignite Chicago, I believe. Some guys running the demo there. So that's all good, but what sort of number can we actually get if we combine both these workloads? So what I've got here is similar. Four workers for reads, four workers for writes. We're targeting our write and our read disk here to see what sort of combined numbers we can get. And it will be interesting to see what I actually get because I've had a little bit of variation in terms of the numbers that are in there. The maximum that I've seen is around about 200,000 IOPS. And that was split at the maximum of 80,000 writes, which we're getting up to there now, and the actual read IOPS, we're kicking around about 1,000. But you see, it's scaling; it's climbing up. Actually, if I change it to, so slightly different ways, it's. Measures its metrics, start of the test and the last update. This one fluctuates a bit more. So we can see we're getting around about 170,000, and that'll actually, it will get up to around about 200,000 IOPS I've seen. I haven't seen what the published amount of total reads that you can get for the GS5. Every time I've tried it, it's been around capping around about 160,000 read IOPS. From that cache. So I'm going to take a stab in the dark and say that that's probably the limit for that. Cool. All right, doing pretty good for time. So hopefully what I've explained here and shown you here has given you a bit more knowledge into how the back end of Azure storage is pieced together. You know, you'll be able to walk away now and think about how your systems are put together and think about these concepts and how we can get better throughput and IOPS and better efficiency better use of the partition layer and those partition keys that you've been setting there. Some related sessions, if you've got a DeLorean and a flux capacitor, you can go back in time and watch Stu and Steve's demo. You also get some really solid marriage tips out of that one. Use them at your own risk. Or you could just go to Channel 9 and watch that when it's up, giving a really good overview of what's new as infrastructure as a service. Session on Elastic for SQL, shards, pool, and stretch. I think I'm going to head along to that myself because it sounds like a really interesting topic. Backup as a service, using... basically Azure Backup, I believe, storing it in storage, and deploying and securing Azure Resource Manager. That's Thursday, 4:30, yeah. Resource Manager, probably one of the biggest, for me, one of the biggest changes in how we do our IaaS, and I'm really, really looking forward to that role-based access, rather than giving full admin permissions out to if they need access to my portal. Standard stuff, TechNet, MSDN, Virtual Academy. All these sessions will be on Channel 9. I'm not sure when they're being uploaded, but you can go back and relive the greatest moments from your Ignite sessions. And complete your evals. Feedback, this is my first time presenting at Ignite or the TechEd, so I'd love to know how I did. And I think we've got some time for questions, if anyone's got anything.
Yep. The slide where you had the IO that mentioned you were joining a T20 and a T30 together.
Yep.
If you had some terrible bad luck and happened to have all your data strike onto that T20 block, would you get 2,000 IOPS out of that, or does it aggregate across it?
So the question there was if we had a P20 and a P30 and all the data was assigned to that, would we potentially be hitting that P20 IOP limit rather than would it be aggregated? So I believe using storage spaces, it's aggregated across both. So it's very unlikely that you'll be constrained by that limit on there. Cool. Any other questions? Nope. We're good. We're done. Thank you very much.